namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Today being the anniversary, the occasion of remembering the passing away of our teacher, Venerable Ajahn Chah, I'd be happy to spend some time together this evening reflecting on some of the outstanding qualities of him. Approximately five years that I had the good fortune of living in close proximity with him is something that I will be eternally indebted to him for. And I'm sure he didn't need me around, but I needed him. Something that I am profoundly grateful for. And I would say that all of us, although I'm not sure whether anybody here at Ajahn Punya, did you meet Ajahn Chah? No. So there isn't anybody else here who actually met Ajahn Chah, but that we have this practice place and we have the recorded teachings and the example of those who practice with him to inspire and encourage you. This is something that we are all indeed also indebted and very fortunate to have received. Because without an example, without a living example, it's very difficult. It's, we can read the scriptures, we can read the commentaries, and we can have a very good grasp on the theory of practice, but so long as we ourselves are still struggling with obstructions, difficulties, then it's very, very hard work. But if we have the example of somebody who has practiced and realized the fruits of practice, it becomes a lot easier. And so to have had this experience of living in his company and seeing what it's like to be with somebody who is experiencing the fruits of practicing the Dhamma, not just having a good grasp on the theory, but somebody who's really surrendered themselves to the practice and realized the benefits for themselves is a tremendously precious and wonderful thing. Now, probably many of you have read and heard talks by other monks who have lived with Ajahn Chah, and plenty has been said about him, and everybody has their own take on his characteristics, what it was like, what he was like. And this evening I was spending time just before puja considering what really stands out in my experience of living with him. Yes, he had studied the scriptures, and yes, he knew what he was talking about, and he could sit on the Dhamma seat and give great talks. He could also give profoundly boring talks, I can assure you. He could talk for hours and hours, and he had great equanimity. He didn't seem to be the slightest bit interested in entertaining us. If he thought it was good for us to have some encouragement to practice equanimity and patience, then he would give us all the reasons for that. When I cast my mind back and I think of the experience of being with him, one of the things that really Really, well, there's three things actually. I've settled on three things that really stand out, and top of the list is just how wonderfully kind he was. That he's known for being a very wise being, and he clearly was a very wise being. People from all over the country, all over the world, and including the King of Thailand, would come and pay their respects. Businessmen, aristocracy, the local farmers would come to be in his company because of his profound wisdom, and he was known for that. But I think sometimes we emphasize that a little bit too much. Yeah. Because if we imitate those beings that we think are realized and we feel are worth imitating, what are the qualities we're going to focus on? And so when I think of my time with him, this is one of the qualities that really stands out. There's this extraordinary experience of his kindness, just being in his company. And the particular incidents that I can remember, but also just the general atmosphere of how considerate and kind he was. And I can remember very vividly a particular incident of when I had gotten a seriously bad infection in my ankle. I'd been into the local town, a little village in those days called Warin Chamra, and it's well developed these days, but in those days it was really the Wild West and very rough and ready. And I had been into town for some reason, I forget what it was, but walking along the street, and I'd slipped off the pavement into the drain, which was in fact an open sewer, and just a little graze on my ankle. Didn't think it was very much, but I ended up, I think, walking most of the way back to the monastery, and within a few days I had this really massive, weeping, ugly infection that developed into a horrible ulcer and lasted for a very long time, and I even had trouble walking. And I can remember one day when Ajahn Chah, as he would come over to visit and see how the Western monks were doing and give us a little encouragement. And he was asking Ajahn Sumedho, you know, everybody okay? And he said, oh yeah, people are okay, but that one New Zealand monk, he seems to have picked up some pretty ugly infection. And he called me forward. I can still remember him calling me forward and looking down at my foot, asking me to pull my foot up so he could see it. And just the extraordinary quality of total attention. It's just this, what it's like to receive somebody's total attention. What a gift that is. What a beautiful thing that is. He wasn't feeling sorry for me. I forget what he actually said, but it wasn't, there, you poor thing. It wasn't like that. It was the quality of attention, which is really the characteristic of loving kindness. Yeah. When the heart is unobstructed with fear, with greed, with ill will, with resentment, when the heart is unobstructed, that is the characteristic, loving kindness. We call it loving kindness, but what is it actually? It's the heart that's not obscured. And to be on the receiving end of Ajahn Chah's unobstructed attention and the warmth, the friendship, the caring was a beautiful gift. And it wasn't the only occasion. Other occasions when I'd go and see him, I remember one particular occasion when I was absolutely racked with doubt. Wasn't rare in those days. Just the mind was lost in confusion and doubt and worry and anxiety, and I was losing sleep and I didn't know what to do. And another young monk there whose name was Warapanyo, who some of you might have read some of his translations and books that he's written, Paul Breiter, and he was very fluent in the local dialect, not just in speaking Thai, but also in the local Isan dialect. And And he was going to go over to see Ajahn Chah. Actually, he was going to go over and ask to disrobe, which I don't think Ajahn Chah was very kind to him. But he was very kind to me. He was very kind to me. And Waraponyo was translating for me and expressing how this this skinny, scrawny young monk was caught up in all this worry and anxiety and doubt. And again, I still remember very vividly just the gaze of Ajahn Chah. And what he said was, in Thai, what he said was, Pom Khoi Ben Yang Nan, which translates as, oh yeah, I've been there. I've been there. And that empathy, that where you, where no judgment, where somebody, you feel somebody really sees you, and there's no judgment. Oh, again, once again, what a wonderful gift that is, and what a beautiful thing that is, and truly something worth emulating. You know, I think the meditation traditions of Buddhism in all the countries are well known for expressions of the spiritual warrior, and certainly the way that we Westerners have picked it up in our experience and going to Thailand and becoming familiar with what's known as the Kubra Ajahn tradition, and you hear these Western monks talking about these great austerities that the monks went through and their daring battles with Mara, and yeah, certainly that's good to know about, and the energy of the spiritual warrior is absolutely essential. But if that's all we've got is the energy of the spiritual warrior, well, I can tell you, over the years that I've been living as a monk, which is getting on for 40 now, I've seen a lot of very wounded, seriously wounded spiritual warriors who went into battle not properly prepared. So one of the great gifts of a wonderful teacher like Ajahn Chah is they set an example for us. And so this is an example that I think is something that, well, even when you read the teachings, you can still hear it coming through the translated teachings, the care, the kindness, the concern of the teacher for his disciples. All he wants to do is help. And this is something that if we, as we do, I'm sure all aspire to liberation and freedom from suffering, we want to emulate our teachers. I think this is one of the profound qualities that we're wise to emulate. Yes, the daring spirit. Yes, the energy of the warrior. But also the limitless kindness. Even if we don't necessarily, as we probably almost surely don't, feel the same quality of unobstructed kindness that he experienced, we can still act as if, or as they say in AA, fake it till you make it. Yeah? It's not the real thing, but if in our hearts we generate the aspiration and emulate our teachers by practicing kindness, not pretending to be kind, but where there's an opportunity to let go of old habits of resentment, old habits of contracting out of fear, not to just default to that willful spiritual warrior energy of I'm going to overcome this and I'm going to break through, and as important as these things are, and yes, we can read in the scriptures the Buddha talking about my bones are going to break and my blood is going to dry up, and yes, certainly, but let's not forget that warm-heartedness of our teachers and the willingness to forgive. The willingness to forgive those who've harmed us. The willingness to forgive ourselves. And that also connects with another quality which for me really stands out when I reflect on my time with Ajahn Chah, and that is the quality of agility. Now, I don't know what the Pali word for that is or even what the Thai word for that is, but I do know what that looks like when you see it in somebody. Yeah. Not all monks and nuns, not all spiritual teachers manifest the kind of agility that means you can adjust according to time and place. You know, the conditions of the world, the outer world and the inner world, are always changing. The conditions that we find ourselves in, that we experience and in daily life and in formal practice, are always changing. And if we approach spiritual practice with a very materialistic attitude, which is inevitable in the beginning, but if we don't let go of that, if we don't move on past that, then we're going to hold to our spiritual ideals and become rigid. But where there's, you know, rigidity, it's like rigor mortis. It's what, you know, it's what happens when you're dead. And sadly, this is a risk in the spiritual life. You know, we can start off with tremendous enthusiasm and tremendous energy and really throw ourselves into practice with zeal and commitment and hope. But if we don't have this flexibility, if we don't have this agility, if we hold fast to our ideals and our ideas, our opinions, then there's a risk that we'll break. So Ajahn Chah was anything but rigid, anything but fixated on views and opinions. In fact, it's something that he spoke about, not really. One of the things that frightens him about his disciples and one of the things he has to deal with constantly is their attachment to views and opinions, you know, particularly Westerners, that because of the kind of education we've had, we just love our ideas. We love our opinions, and they're like our credentials, and we fight over them. We love fighting over them. And if somebody comes up with one opinion, and we just counter it with another opinion, because we're addicted to contentiousness. And certainly this was something that Ajahn Chah was way beyond. And to have that was a great gift. To see somebody who is so consistently agile, able to adapt, able to adjust, whatever was happening. Again, talking about this expression of total attention, that when people would come to see Ajahn Chah, whether it's the local villagers with their problems. I remember there was one night a group of villagers brought this young girl who'd come, who she was in a seriously disturbed mental state, and they were convinced that she was possessed by a demon, and I don't know whether she was possessed or whether she was deranged or what her situation was, but certainly she was very distressed. And I remember the amount of time that Ajahn Chah spent with her and with the villagers that evening, giving his total loving, caring attention. And that then you see him in another situation where some local businessman is coming to him and wants to be treated very importantly, and Ajahn Chah could adjust according to that situation. Or if he has to go to Bangkok and he's in a hospital ward where I saw him, I remember visiting him when he was sick in hospital and out of his comfort zone, but he was still very comfortable, no problem at all, sitting cross-legged on his hospital bed there, receiving doctors and nurses who were coming in to see him. No problem. Or when he came to the West, and when he jumped on a plane and somebody told him, well, you can't eat betel nut in the West, Lumpur, you've got to give up your betel nut. And I suspect he was addicted to betel nut. It's a very addictive substance. And but you don't chew betel nut in the West, and quite rightly you don't. And if you've seen it, it's like blood dribbling down somebody's chin, and it's really grotesque. And then they kind of spit it into a spittoon, and I can't imagine he would spit on the ground. Certainly not in any populated area, and it looks really grotesque. And if you're not used to it, it's definitely very off-putting. And so he took the advice of the Westerners. He said, "Lumbawa, you can't chew betel nut in the West." So at the airport, he gave away his betel nut. No problem. He probably had a few headaches because that's an addictive substance, but he adjusted. And when he was in the West here, I remember there was one situation that I didn't see it myself, but I heard about, where he went to visit the parents of one of our monks. And as you could, I'm sure, understand, not all parents are delighted with their son living off in some foreign country with belonging to some religious cult or other. And so when Ajahn Chah came to visit the parents of one of the monks, and the father opened the door, and Ajahn Chah produces this great big beaming smile and sticks his hand out and shakes his hand and greets him. Now, this is not something that you would see any senior monk of Ajahn Chah's standing do in Thailand, but he was in tune. One of the characteristics of somebody whose heart is free from obstruction is they're in tune. They're able to adjust. They have agility. And I mentioned it this evening because not only does it stand out in my mind, but I think it's a spiritual quality that is worth emulating. It's worth registering. Agility. Don't let rigor mortis kick in. Don't be holding too tightly to spiritual techniques, spiritual opinions. As, again, probably many of you have heard, the Ajahn Chah sharing the example of one of his teachers, I think it was Ajahn Tongrat, who he would tell his students that when the kilesas come towards you, if they come high, you've got to be able to duck under them. If they come low, you've got to be able to jump over them. Graphic way of pointing out the need for agility and contrasting the risk we have with our materialistic attitudes to become rigid, to hold on to. Just because we start out with something that seems to work, then we tend to want to cling to it. But that's not the way. The Maya is very devious. Or you could say the deluded tendencies of our mind are very devious. We will pick up some spiritual discipline and it'll be working for a while, but then the deluded ego will learn how to imitate it and it won't be working anymore because we're not doing the real thing anymore. So agility, I would suggest, is something really worth thinking about, and personally something that I'm immensely grateful to having had that manifest in the life of Ajahn Chah. So as I started off by saying, the theory of practice is one thing, but the practice of practice, it's completely different. They're connected, but it's completely different. Just the same as a photograph of Thailand is completely different from the experience. You can look at all these high-resolution, gorgeous photographs of the northeast of Thailand and the lovely cooties and the lovely monks and the lovely sunshine, and compare it to Northumberland, grey, cold stone walls, no sunshine, and grumpy, pale-faced, pasty-looking monks. It must be so wonderful to be in Thailand. Well, the photograph looks like that, but I can tell you, those photographs don't show you the mosquitoes or the ants. The ants, these things are endlessly biting you. Walking to evening puja to get all devotional, to go and be all spiritual, and you stand in a line of these stinging ants that are just within seconds, they're really already racing up your legs and stinging you, and you're stomping your feet and killing dozens of these things. And so much for being devotional and spiritual, you're just full of irritation and rage. And then the endlessly hot, miserable months of the summer, you're just sweating all day and all night. You know, your cootie, that gorgeous cootie's got a tin roof. It's just like living in a sauna. And I'm not making this up. This is true. This is absolutely true. And the food that looks so lovely, goodness knows what chemicals they've sprayed on it. And the noise from the village, because they're drunk and partying all night, week after week. And again, I'm not making this up. No disrespect intended to my dear Thai friends, but this is the difference between a photograph that you see in a nice glossy book and the reality. And so it is with the theory, which is the photograph, and the actuality of practice. One of the examples Ajahn Chah used to give was, he said it's like, in this, he talked about this, the theory and practice of practice. He said it's like with medicine. You know, he said, you wouldn't want to have a doctor who'd never studied medicine practice on you. Well, actually, the example he gave was a herbal doctor. Somebody who had never studied anything doesn't know anything. But if all the herbal doctor has done is studied and hasn't practiced, well, that's not it either. So he wanted us to understand that the study of practice and the practice of the practice, they're connected, they inform each other, but they're not the same. And so not to mistake them, not to mistake that glossy photograph for the northeast of Thailand for the real thing. Don't believe it. When you go to the northeast of Thailand, you'll have culture shock. Now, hopefully you'll get over it and then you'll come to realize all the wonderful benefits and advantages of being there. But it's not the same thing as the photograph. And so we need to be prepared for that. In the beginning of practice, we can be inspired and really get off on listening to talks and reading books and thinking we know something. But when we're practicing the practice, we need to let go of all the ideas we have about practice. And that's something else altogether. So there's certainly in Ajahn Chah's teaching and in his example, this is something that he pointed out in speaking about it. And there was a talk he gave one year when there was a whole lot of young monks who'd come to live at his monastery during the Wasa, during the rains retreat, and a lot of university students, and they were having Vinaya lessons, instruction on the Book of Discipline. And one of the monks there had been appointed as the Vinaya master, and instead of giving lessons and sitting there and talking over the Vinaya training with the young monks, what this teacher monk had done was he'd prepare tapes in his kuti. He'd sit there and he'd prepare recordings about the Vinaya, and then the monks would all sit there and listen to these recordings. And one day Ajahn Chah went over there and gave a very inspiring, we've still got a recording of the talk, it's a very useful, inspiring, very wise and skillful encouragement with regards to the discipline. And one of the things he points out is, he says, you can listen to these tapes or you can study the books and you can think you understand the discipline, but believe me, you don't, until you've lived it for many years. You know, that's why we have, in the monastic training, we have this five-year Navaka training, the first years of being in training, or the Navaka years. That for those 5 years, that's the opportunity to study, to read, to remember, to practice, to cultivate, and hopefully to internalize the spirit behind the form of the rules. We can know the form of the rules, we can maybe recite all the rules, but that doesn't mean to say we know the rules. To know the rules, we have to live by the rules for a good number of years, and then hopefully we've internalized the spirit, the meaning, the essence of the rules. And so the study of practice or the theory of practice and the practice of practice are different things, and we need to know both. They inform each other, but they're very different. And that process of transforming our initial understanding into something that's more grounded in the body and lived through our daily life is something that takes extraordinary patience. And there's another quote from Ajahn Chah that he's well known for, and to hear him say it, and the understanding that behind him saying it is a great gift, and that's the expression he has, which was "Tungti sotkami kwam oton taunana." Kwam oton is patient endurance. Tungti sotkami kwam oton taunana. So in the end, all we've got is patient endurance. Yeah. Now that's not probably the way we think. Well, almost certainly it's not the way we think, because we want to see progress. We want to see results. We want insights. We want to know that we're developing. And fair enough, in the beginning, we do need some evidence, some encouragements. The effort that we're making and the sitting still of a meditation and restraining our actions of body and speech to keep the precepts, and we want to see some benefit from this affirmation, this confirmation that the path of practice is worth the effort, yes, in the beginning. But as we practice more and more, we realize that, well, we've got to get to the point where we do realize that the karmic momentum of our past heedlessness, actually, yeah, where we've acted out of unawareness, yeah, through when we were uninformed, uneducated with matters of the heart, yeah, before we developed an understanding of Dhamma, in this life, in previous lives, and we built up a momentum of avoidance of reality. Yeah. It's like an ocean liner, you know, you decide you're going to stop an ocean liner. You can't stop an ocean liner, you can slow down an ocean liner. Yeah. And so it is with the momentum of ignorance and conceit, which are the result of our tendencies to avoid reality. Yeah. We have these tendencies to avoid reality, we develop habits of greed, aversion and delusion, and then they pollute and distort consciousness, and so we've got the self-perpetuating cycle of building up, indulging in delusion, and it's got very painful consequences, which eventually all of us get tired of and decide we're going to do something about it, which is what we're doing here. But even though we've decided with heart and mind and body and speech to do something about it, it doesn't mean to say that the consequences of our past heedlessness are going to immediately cease. You know, we can have some really life-changing experiences of opening and clarity and understanding, and that can be deeply unsettling and inspiring and encouraging and energizing. But that doesn't mean to say that it's all over. And it's a big mistake, in fact, to think that it's all over. You know, because the habits, the old momentum, can catch up with us. We can get used to our new insights, maybe. Our previous amazing understanding just becomes just run of the mill. And then we've still got our old habits to deal with. Or the insights may be profound, but that's while you're sitting or on your own. And when you get up from your cushion and you start talking to people and doing the dishes and painting the window frames and fixing the computer and whatever else we're doing, the old habits of me kick in. And that's where infinite patient endurance is called for. Tungti sukkamikwam otontanan. Even though we may have a good level of understanding, even if we've got insight, in the end, what we work with is patient endurance. Now, again, with talking about our teacher this evening, Ajahn Chah, his example of extraordinary patience is a great gift. As probably those of you that have been around the monastery for a while have seen that there's quite a big turnover. You know, people come and go through these places, and not just our monasteries here in the West, but also in Thailand. Year in, year out, you get people coming and joining the monastery, visiting the monastery, staying in the monastery for a period of time, and then going again. And then there's a new intake, a new lot come. And for those who stay there, for the senior monks, they've got to tell the new ones over and over again. Same old thing, over and over again. You know, carry your bowl like this. After the meal, this is how we behave. And when we come into the Dhamma hall, this is how we behave. And well, speaking personally, I know I sometimes reach what I feel like is my limit. I think, oh, how many times do I have to tell these people the thing over and over again? Turn the lights off, close the windows, don't waste the offerings that the lay people have given. And well, that it's good to remember the example of somebody like Ajahn Chah. He never reached, at least as far as I could see, the limit. Because when the heart is not obstructed with me and my way, then it manifests as patience. It just understands. It just understands. This is the way it is. So long as we're still lost in the momentum of me and my way, well, it's very tedious. So I don't want to do it. I can't be bothered telling these people, wear proper footwear when you're using the axe, you know. No, you can't use a chainsaw just because you want to. You've got to have a license to use the chainsaw. Yeah. Wash the paintbrushes after you've used them. Yeah. Clean the shovel before you put it away. Yeah. Now, these outer expressions of patient endurance, of course, if we train ourselves in them, well, then the benefit is that the utter tediousness of the monkey mind becomes workable. Yeah. I'm sure we all know what the monkey mind feels like. Aimlessly running off after our fantasies and running away from things that we don't like and dreaming of things that we like. And that's what the monkey mind does. Mm. And if we don't have patient endurance, well, then it's a real ordeal. Mm. So cultivating these wonderful qualities, so beautifully exemplified in the life of Ajahn Chah and all the great teachers, are enhanced by patient endurance. If you're cultivating kindness, you're bound to fail. You think kindness is a wonderful quality. You can chant the discourse on loving kindness, the Karaniya Metta Sutta, over and over again. Maybe you make a practice of it. You can chant it 108 times every day. You know, great discipline. But you're probably still going to get angry. What do you do then? We're patient and we begin again. Yeah. Patient endurance is what we cultivate when we're not having a good time. Yeah. There's a lot of other aspects of the training that we become refined and honed down when we're feeling good. When we're not feeling good, there's a risk that we can jump to the conclusion that we're failing. It's very easy to do that. When, for instance, if we feel fear, something comes up from goodness knows where. Goodness knows where. And we just, night after night, we've got fear to deal with. Or every time you go out on your walking meditation track, you start feeling anxious. Maybe don't even know why. Sometimes it appears totally irrational. Obviously, there are causes for it, but we don't necessarily see the causes. Maybe we've been avoiding them for so long that they're difficult to see. Yeah. We're not having a good time. Yeah. Well, it's very easy to jump to the conclusion, because we're not having a good time, that we're failing. Well, that's not necessarily the case. We can always succeed in practice by deciding to be patient. Yeah, not bitter endurance, not like, well, I'll grit my teeth and bear this and eventually I'll get over it. No, that's not patient endurance. Patient endurance is a willingness to bear with that which is unbearable. And similarly with agility, to the flexibility, the right kind of flexibility. I'm not talking about the flexibility or the agility that's the kind of whatever attitude. That's not what we're talking about. But we have looked at our tendencies to cling often enough, our pursuit of some sort of synthetic security. We've got a good enough perspective on that to recognize when we're holding on to something that maybe used to work for us, but now it's time to let go and to feel insecure. I don't know, actually. I used to feel like I knew what I was doing. I used to have this clarity. And now I don't know anymore. Yeah, well, that's what we can know. If we're agile, we're willing to let go of the perception of me progressing and really getting somewhere and stop and just stand there. Sometimes that's what's called for. We can stop making progress. This crazy idea, I think I referred to it in a talk recently that we have in our society, the economic theory of perpetual growth is absolutely insane, ridiculous. There can't be perpetual growth. But it can, the concept is around and it can affect us, and we can carry this materialistic attitude into our spiritual practice. Well, if there's agility and what's called for is stop trying to make progress, but simply be with this. Be with this uncomfortable feeling of insecurity. I really want to know. Well, with patience and agility, maybe what we get to see is that that's just what we need to be with. Yeah. Wanting to be sure. Yeah. That was what drove me into hellish states of doubt. It was this addiction to wanting to be sure. Now, fortunately, Ajahn Chah wasn't caught in that addiction. And actually on that occasion when I went to see him, I referred to before, and he said, oh, I've been there. He also went on to say, when something is unsure and you want to make it sure, guess what? You're going to suffer. Yeah. If something is uncertain and you try to make it certain, you're creating a problem. But if we're caught up in the momentum of always trying to be certain, caught up in our addiction of trying to be sure, that's what we do. Lack of agility. Unfortunate. But hopefully, eventually, we get tired of the suffering and we drop it and we surrender and we say, right, it's like this. It's uncomfortable, but I've got the willingness, the patience to bear with the unbearable feeling of wanting to be sure. So, again, the example of somebody like Ajahn Chah, and also in my first year I had the good fortune of living with Ajahn Tate, a very wise, great teacher, lived in Thailand at the same time as Ajahn Chah. This example of extraordinary kindness that is the expression of undivided attention. The heart is not divided, the heart is not obscured, the heart is not distorted with greed, aversion, delusion as it is for us. And so that experience of receiving that kindness, of witnessing that agility. And the third quality that, reflecting on earlier this evening, came to my mind and really stands out, still stands out, is that although these great beings, and talking this evening about Ajahn Chah, although Ajahn Chah was recognized as a great master, you know, Ajahn Chah was a master, a meditation master. You see it written about in the books, and you hear people talking about the meditation master, Ajahn Chah. The experience of living with Ajahn Chah was, what you saw in Ajahn Chah's company was not a master, but a servant. Ajahn Chah was a servant of the Triple Gem. Ajahn Chah was a servant of the Dhamma. Ajahn Chah was a servant of the Buddha, servant of the Sangha. And it was a wonderful example to witness. And you could see it in the way that he would bow. When Ajahn Chah went to bow, it wasn't a perfunctory bop, 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 kind of get this out of the way and get on with the good stuff. You know, get on with sitting on my high seat and being impressive. it certainly wasn't like that. When Ajahn Chah stopped and bowed, Ajahn Chah stopped and bowed. And there was a surrendering, and a truly beautiful thing to see. I remember similarly when I was visiting with Ajahn Mahabua, who had a reputation for being a real spiritual wild man. And I remember when he would come into the meditation hall in the morning, and he would go straight to the main shrine and stop and bow. And this is also something that we can, I think, skillfully, wisely emulate from our teachers. We can cultivate. You know, instead of just do this and get it out of the way, when we bow, stop. Yeah. And remember what we chant every morning. I am a servant of the Buddha. The Buddha is my Lord and guide. The Buddha is sorrow's destroyer who bestows blessings on me. Yeah. I am a servant of the Dhamma. Yeah. That contrasts powerfully with the condition that perhaps we ourselves, and certainly much of the world, is afflicted by the global affliction. A few centuries ago, the plague was rampant across this part of the planet, and tens of thousands of people died because of this disease called the plague. Well, the disease that's rampant now is narcissism. A global pandemic of it's all about me. And cultivating this aspiration, cultivating the disposition of a servant of the Triple Gem is the medicine for this malady, is the medicine for this disorder. And having the opportunity to witness the life of somebody like Ajahn Chah is indeed a great gift and a great, great inspiration. So thank you very much this evening for your attention.